reported in the Talmud that a non-Jew came to Hillel and said, I would like to be explained to me what Judaism is while standing on one foot. I don't know how great an athlete he was, how long he could stand on one foot. But if I were able to stand on one foot for about 45 minutes and I asked that question, this is what I would have answered. There's a story authored by Rav Nachman of Braslov. This story concerns a royal family, a king, a queen, and a prince living in a palace. One day at lunch, the prince is seized with an emotional disorder. He completely disrobes, climbs under the table, and starts to crow like a rooster. Very disturbing. The king and queen call their wise men, their psychiatrists, not the same group of people. But no one is able to improve the condition of the prince. Finally, when everyone else has given up hope, a rabbi in the kingdom presents himself and says, I have a therapy which I believe will be helpful for your son, but it's a radical therapy, and I must ask you to promise not to interfere. Having no alternative, the king and queen promise, whereupon the rabbi completely disrobes, climbs under the table, and starts to crow like a rooster. So now there are two of them under the table. This condition persists for a number of days. One morning, the prince awakes to find that the rabbi has put on his pants. That's a shock. The prince says to the rabbi, I don't understand. I thought you were a rooster, as I am a rooster. Roosters don't wear pants. The rabbi says, you're right. I'm a rooster, just like you. Couldn't a rooster wear pants? Does the fact that I cover the lower half of my body with a piece of cloth change what I am? I'm a rooster wearing pants. Well, the prince thought it over, and he couldn't refute the logic. A piece of cloth can't change what you are. Next morning, it's the shirt. The rabbi has a shirt on, and the prince says, what? A rooster wearing a shirt? And the rabbi says, why not? Why couldn't a rooster wear a shirt? The story goes on. The rabbi leads the prince step by step back into all the trappings of normal human behavior. Sit on a chair. A rooster could sit on a chair. Use cutlery to eat your food. There might be a dexterity problem, but we'll get one of B.F. Skinner's students to work on it with stimulus reinforcement and condition reinforcement, and probably make, get it to work. And in the end, the prince is behaving to all purposes just like a normal human being, still convinced that he's a rooster. That's the end of the story. This story raises a number of deep questions. One I just mentioned for your perusal: can a person be mistaken about what he is? We can make all sorts of interesting mistakes, but this seems to be a very deep and personal mistake. I don't know what I myself am. Another question, the one that I want to deal with this afternoon, is what is it to the essence of humanity? What is it that makes us unique? Is it our eating habits, or our clothing, or our ethical sense, or our technology, or our mathematics? Every philosophy, every religion, every worldview must have an answer to what makes us human and what essentially divides us from everything else in the universe. Judaism has an answer also, and in about 35 minutes I hope to get to at least one way of putting that answer. But first we have to take a brief look at mysticism, meaning, and mitzvah. What is a mystic? A mystic is a person who says that our everyday reality, tables and chairs, red giants, white dwarfs, black holes, intifadas. Our everyday reality is not the ultimately real. Ultimate reality lies in a different dimension, with different entities and different processes, and he, the mystic, is in touch with that dimension, either because he experiences it directly or because he's read the writings of those who have experienced it. Up to here, all mystics will agree. Now they subdivide. Some say that the mystical dimension alone is real. Nothing else is real. Everything else is an illusion, just a mistake. If you went somewhat further east than Israel, you would run into the concept of Maya, meaning illusion, or dream stuff in Shakespeare's terminology. The everyday world is simply a dream. Reality lies in a different dimension altogether. I don't know how many of you have had the misfortune to have read The Republic by Plato. I see some of you have. You'll remember book 6, where Plato describes the myth of the cave. People in a deep, winding cave at a point where no sunlight penetrates. And they are chained to one wall of the cave. Around the bend there's a fire burning. And other people are holding up figurines in front of the fire, casting shadows on the opposite wall. For the people in chains, those shadows are their world. What must be done, Plato asks, to introduce them to the real world, break their chains, lead them out of the cave, and when their eyes adjust to the brilliance of the sunshine, and they see mountains and valleys and vegetation and animals and birds and insects and the sky, they'll be introduced to a reality utterly unlike the shadows in the cave. This could be a model for the first type of mystic. Our world is a world of shadows, and only he is in touch with reality. Then there's a second type of mystic who says that our world is real, the world of furniture and astronomy. You did recognize the red giant and the white dwarf? Yeah. And politics is real, but what it is can be understood only in terms of the underlying reality of the mystical dimension. A model for the second type of mystic, I think, is the physicist. This is a lectern, a solid lectern. And the physicist tells us that it's more than 99% empty space. If you hadn't learned that at the age of 4, if someone had told you that first as an adult, you'd be very surprised. Why would anyone think that this is almost all empty space? It doesn't feel that way. It doesn't look that way. And the message of the physicist is, you can't trust your eyes. And you can't trust your fingertips to reveal the character of the lectern. The lectern is real. It's not an illusion. It's not a dream. But what it is could be very different from what your eyes and your fingertips tell you. The physicist will tell us that this lectern is a hotbed of frantic activity. First of all the molecules are engaged in vibratory motion. Heat is the random motion of molecules. And inside the atom, according to the old picture, the electrons are whizzing around. And according to the new picture, they aren't there till you look. And when you're not looking, they're replaced by purple fuzz. Okay, it's not really purple fuzz, but it's the complex square root of the probability of finding it when you look. And in the nucleus, the protons and neutrons are exchanging gluons at a blinding speed. And when you protest it, you don't perceive any motion at all. I don't hear anything going on. I don't feel any motion. I don't see any motion. The physicist says again, you can't trust your fingers or your eyes or your ears to reveal the character of the lectern. The second mystic has a similar message. Our everyday world is real, but what it is can be appreciated only in terms of the underlying mystical dimension. Now, I want to take one element of the Jewish mystical picture, a mysticism of type 2, and show you how consciousness of that element of the picture changes our understanding of the meaning of everyday events, and then we will have a fresh perspective on what a mitzvah is, and then finally we'll come back and answer the question, what makes us unique? Judaism teaches that God created and creates the world, past tense and present tense. Creation is not an event that happened N years ago, value of N to be discussed on another occasion perhaps, but it is an ongoing process. It's a continuous process. There's a flow of energy into our universe which gives it its existence, and without which it would simply cease to exist. You know what a Van de Graaff generator is? If you come from Philadelphia, if you've been to the Franklin Institute, you've actually seen it operate. It generates static electricity. It's a giant wooden frame with metal plates on it, and there's a big wheel fitted with thin metal brushes. And when you turn the wheel, and the metal scrapes against the metal, it generates static electricity, and then you have one pole here, one pole there, and there's a giant spark that goes from pole to pole. And in Philadelphia, they hold a big oak board, and the spark smashes through the oak board, and all the children become physicists. Our world is like that spark. As long as you're turning the wheel and generating the energy, the spark exists. The minute you stop turning the wheel, the spark disappears. Our world is like that spark. There has to be a constant influx of energy maintaining its existence. Constant creation is a key element in the Jewish mystical picture. Let's take that idea and trace out its consequences. In general, it means everything that exists, moment by moment, exists because there's an immediate divine decision that it should exist. Divine creativity is going on continuously, applied to everything, not only august items like the human soul, but every beat of the wing of every mosquito, and the motes of dust dancing in the sunbeam, and the Heisenberg energy of so-called empty space, all of it is a production of God's creative activity, moment by moment. This means that everything that exists is a bridge to God. It's a manifestation of God's immediate ongoing activity, and it's a bridge to God. Everything that exists can be utilized in a way to realize that bridge, to create a connection to God, or, because we have free will, can be ignored or even destroyed. And the Torah gives us a way of realizing those potentials. This is epitomized in an incident that took place in Rabbi Akiva's life. A Roman once challenged Rabbi Akiva, whose actions are greater, man's actions or God's actions? Now, the Roman had a trick up his sleeve, if a toga has a sleeve, and he thought, no Jew is going to compare man with God. For the Jews, God is an infinite, transcendent creator, and man is but a finite creature. So, thought the Roman, Rabbi Akiva will have to answer that God's actions are greater. And then, thought the Roman, I'll trap him with circumcision. If God's actions are greater, why aren't you satisfied with the fetus the way God produces it? No, you go God one better. And that will be a contradiction. So thought the Roman. But Rabbi Akiva, anticipating the argument, said to the Roman, man's actions are greater. And when the Roman was reluctant to accept that statement, yes, please go. When the Roman was reluctant to accept that statement from Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva said, give me 5 minutes and I'll prove it to you. The Roman acquiesced. Rabbi Akiva left and came back 5 minutes later. In one hand he had a sheaf of wheat, and in the other hand he had a piece of cake. And he said to the Roman, which would you rather eat? You could probably guess what the Roman said. I'll take the cake. Rabbi Akiva said, well, God made the wheat, and man made the cake, and you just chose the cake. Furthermore, said Rabbi Akiva, when your children are born, don't you cut off the umbilical cord? And when the Roman admitted that they did, Rabbi Akiva said, so you make one cut, and we make two cuts. For that, you're throwing a brick at us? Okay, he didn't say it that way. But that was the import, you know. I mean, what are you complaining about us if you're doing a similar action? That was enough for the Roman. He retired in disgrace. But since we're Jewish, we get to ask questions. Wait a minute, Rabbi Akiva. You're comparing man's actions with God's actions by comparing wheat with cake? Is that a fair comparison? And exactly how does man make the cake? Doesn't he use the wheat which God provided? And deeper, aren't we taking advantage of the laws of chemistry, which are just the pattern of God's unfolding recreation of the world moment by moment? Rabbi Akiva's point was slightly different. He was pointing out that the product of man's actions is superior to the product of God's actions. Raw wheat can be chewed, and some minimal nutrition can be extracted. Starving people have done that, actually. But it can't compare to cake, or lasagna, or pizza, or other things you can make with ground and processed whole wheat flour, of course. Organically grown. The point Rabbi Akiva was making is this: God creates the world and leaves it unfinished, and man completes it. Man realizes its raw potential. And that really is the answer to the challenge from circumcision. We're not going into competition with God by creating our own fetuses ex nihilo, which are pre-circumcised. We're taking the fetus as God created it, and then we're completing it, perfecting it with a final touch. And that is emblematic of our relationship to the world in general. And by the way, let me insert a political footnote. The fact that we're talking about a physical transformation is because we're dealing with a Roman. The Romans understood the physical world. But this idea is not limited to the physical world. When you take an apple from a tree and it's ready to eat, still, it has a potential to be used in a way that realizes its potential as a bridge to God, or ignored or destroyed, whether or not you have to bake it or do anything else before you're able to consume it. This is the general import of the idea of continuous creation. In every moment, with respect to every item of your experience, you have a potential bridge to God. Now let's take that idea and apply it to meaning. The meanings of events in our everyday lives. Okay, I'm a philosopher. Let me start at the top. What is meaning? That's the sort of thing that philosophers ask, right? Your eyes go defocused and you think, when am I going to get out of here? It's just crazy. Let me try to bring it down to earth a little bit. Is meaning contained in something itself, by itself, individually, autonomously? Or is meaning a matter of connections, relations, interactions, consequences? What kind of thing is meaning? Let me give you some examples, and I hope the examples will convey the idea that I'm trying to create. It was actually a thing. What's the meaning of a circle? There's one circle. There's another circle. Here's another circle in context. U.S. Not Canadian, not New Zealand, not Australian, U.S. The real thing. Right, what's the meaning of a circle? Give me a few more. What's the meaning of the English word that's spelled P-A-I-N? Does it refer to an unpleasant experience or to a ubiquitous food? If you happen to know French. A person sitting in an automobile and he puts his arm out the window like this. Is he signaling a right turn or making a political statement? Let's see. A circle could be a symbol for the sun or a smile or a numeral, depending upon the context in which it's found. P-A-I-N is either pain in English or pain in French, which means bread. And if somebody says, why are you bringing in English and French? I spelled the word for you. Just tell me what the word means. It can't be done. A word has a meaning as part of a language. If you take it out of the language, it has no meaning at all. And as far as the hand signal is concerned, well, if it's taking place in Great Britain, it's definitely a political statement because the driver sits over there. Right? I'm not the driver. So I'm not signaling a turn. Meaning is a matter of relationships, context, consequences, interactions. Now, of course, you could protest. If all meaning requires interaction, how does anything get enough substance to stand in a relationship to something else to have a meaning? It's a nice question. Find some retired philosopher to worry about it. The meanings we care about are all defined by relationships and interactions. Smoke means fire, because smoke is related to fire. Why is it that your graduation from university is much more meaningful than yesterday's choice of breakfast cereal? Because you worked 4 years for that piece of paper, and with that piece of paper, you will found a great deal of your subsequent life. That graduation is connected profoundly to a large portion of your life. That's why it's so meaningful, whereas the choice of breakfast cereal has consequences for about 6 minutes. And after that, it's forgotten. The meanings that we deal with in life are matters of relationships and connections and interactions. So, anyone who has a picture of relationships and interactions has a picture of meanings. And when you add to your relationships and interactions, because you have a deep picture of how the world works, you automatically induce new meanings. A chemist will tell you that a burning match and the rusting of your lawn furniture outside in the winter are essentially similar processes. And when you protest, what do you mean? The burning match creates light, heat, and ash, and the rusting furniture produces rust. He'll tell you they're both processes of oxidation. And therefore, they are essentially similar. And then you know, if I paint my lawn furniture in such a way that it blocks out oxygen, it won't rust, because it's a process of oxidation. The chemist has a picture of meanings in the world that other people don't have. Similarly, the Jewish mystical picture creates new meanings because it creates new relationships and new interactions. So I'm going to take this idea of continuous creation and see what new meanings it generates, what new meanings it creates. Let's suppose I'm about to eat an apple. But I don't want to just eat the apple. I want to experience the apple. I'm from California. So, before I eat the apple, I think to myself, where did this apple come from? This apple came from a tree. And the tree came from a seed, which came from a prior apple. Tree, seed, apple, tree, seed, fading off into the indefinite evolutionary past. And when I eat it, I will bite into it. It'll have a certain flavor and aroma. If it's fresh, it'll make a crunch. I will absorb it into my alimentary canal. My body will absorb the nutrients and excrete the waste. This could be seen as a crossing to the plant and animal kingdoms. I'm ready to experience the apple. But if you have the Jewish mystical picture on board, not quite ready yet. Because that apple tree seed does not fade off into an indefinite evolutionary past. It goes back to a definite beginning. A beginning and a continuation authored by a being, capital B, that had in mind, among other things, me. Me and my apple at this moment. So having this apple is part of my relationship with that being. And if I enjoy the apple and the apple brings me benefit, then it creates in me a sense of gratitude and indebtedness to the being that provided it for me. And if I have a very lively sensitivity, as I bite into the apple and experience the pleasure, I could feel that as a caress. Now eating the apple has another dimension of meaning because the Jewish mystical picture gives it other relationships which generate that meaning. And indeed, this leads to another application to everyday life. What is the status of physical pleasure? Judaism cannot be anti-physical pleasure because it's created by God, and since it's created by God, it's meant as a bridge to connecting to Him. Of course, as we said, one can use the bridge, ignore the bridge, or destroy the bridge by our free choices. But it can't be an inherently bad, evil, detracting agent in life? Because it's created by God. Nothing that's created by God in its own character can be inherently evil. It all depends upon how we use it. For example, there are four ways to eat a steak. Way number one, you just finished a very delicious and satisfying dinner of hamburgers. I have to remember to get that right. Yeah. And you push yourself back from the table, and there's a knock on the door. You open up, and a good friend is standing there with a tray covered with a bell, and he says, "Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you." You take off the bell, and underneath is a 2-inch thick sirloin steak smothered in mushrooms, and if you're a vegetarian, it's all soy. And you think, oh. You say, "Thank you so much," and your mind is racing. What am I going to do? I'm stuffed. I'm packed. How am I going to do? How am I going to do that? You say, "Come in, sit down at the table," and then it hits you. You've got the answer, and you say, "Listen, wait here a minute. I'll be right back." And you go to the back of the house. You go into the bathroom. You close the door, and you... Sorry for the audio, right? And then you come out and you're ready to enjoy this thing. That's way number one. Way number two, you've finished 5 hours of doubles tennis. You come home, you throw yourself on the couch and you say, "I'm so hungry, but I'm so tired." And there's a knock on the door and you open it up and it's 2 inches thick with mushrooms and maybe it's soy. And you eat the steak. It's the second way. Third way, you are marrying off one of your children. Now, I can sort of guess by your ages you haven't done this yet. But we, B'Yayin Hara, our family, we have 6 children and they're all married. And I testify to you that marrying off one of your children is one of life's most thrilling, inspiring, and fulfilling experiences. You know the child, if you're a man, from birth, if you're a woman, from conception. It's not a joke. The fetus learns in the womb. This has been shown experimentally. When my wife had her first child, I started talking to the fetus as soon as she knew she was pregnant. I thought she was nuts. And I shared that with her. And she says, "You can think what you want, but I'm talking to the baby." Right? Turns out she was absolutely right. If you like, I'll tell you what the experiments are. It's in the literature. So you have this child from the beginning. And you observe, and of course you give your life's blood to invest in the child's development, and the child becomes independent, capable of setting up his or her own household. There's little in life as thrilling as that. And so you're celebrating. Now, being a Jewish wedding, it's going to last 5 or 6 hours, and it'll be filled with acrobatics and all sorts of tomfoolery, you know, costumes and jugglers, and pour lighter fluid on your hat and ignite it so you have burning hats. I mean, all sorts of stuff, and you're serving a meal. And the meal is steak or soy. Finally, imagine a kingdom whose ruler is universally respected, admired, beloved. Imagine that. Try to imagine that. Yeah. Okay, use your imagination. Now, there are 100 million people in this kingdom, and the king has invited his 25 closest associates to a private dinner party at the palace. And you have received a gold embossed invitation to this dinner party. You come to the palace, you present your invitation to the door, take your place at the table, and the menu is steak. How should we compare and contrast these 4 different ways of eating a steak? Well, the first way, the human being is using his intelligence to lower himself beneath the animals. Animals eat when instinct tells them that they need the nutrition. But they don't empty themselves in order to eat more. They eat when they need to eat. In the second case, after the doubles tennis, you need the nutrition. And therefore, you do need to eat. And if you're going to eat anyway, there's no reason not to enjoy it. In the third case, however, in the marriage, the theme of the experience is a deep and fulfilling emotional experience. Yes, you're having a meal. You can't carry on like that for 5 hours without a meal. And true, if the steak isn't up to par, you will have words with the caterer afterwards. But that will hardly ruin the experience. It is an accompanying nicety to an essentially emotional experience. And in the fourth case, the case of the king, I hope the analogy was transparent, every Shabbos meal and every holiday meal, in the essence of it, God is sitting at the head of the table. We are his guests, invited to an intimate repast with the King, capital K. The theme of that experience is closeness to God. And the meal is how we express that closeness into those conditions. So what you see here is that physical pleasure can contribute to a spiritual experience if it's used that way. Or it can be ignored or degraded depending upon how one uses it. Indeed, as many of you know, traditionally before we eat or drink something, we make a blessing. The usual explanation is, I'm getting permission to take something from God's world and use it, and really destroy it, for my own benefit. So we make the blessing in order to eat or to drink. But there is an exalted minority of people, a very small minority, for whom the order is reversed. Such a person says, blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who creates the fruit of the tree. By the way, present tense, creates the fruit of the tree. And when he says those words, he thinks, orchards. Orchards in bloom. Blossoms of different colors and different fragrances. And then ripening into fruit. The vast variety of fruits. Different colors, different aromas, different flavors, different textures. And with all that beauty and all that pleasure, he says, I want to thank God for that. And I want to praise God for that. I want to say the blessing. Ah, but Jewish law says, you can't just recite blessings. You need an occasion. The occasion means you're going to eat a fruit. So the person says, who has an apple? I need an apple so that I can make the blessing. For such a person, every bite of the apple is an inherently spiritual experience. Because for him, it generates and it expresses his gratitude to God and his attachment to God. At any rate, these are examples of how this part of the Jewish mystical picture, continuous creation, transforms the meanings of our everyday experiences. Now, what is a mitzvah? Of course, as many of you know, the word mitzvah means commandment. But in our context, we could define it as follows. A mitzvah is an action that's appropriate to the total reality. Remember, the everyday world is real, but there's an underlying mystical dimension. A mitzvah is an action that's right all the way down, not just on the surface, but to the underlying dimension as well. If you fail to take account of the mystical dimension, then you risk performing actions which are at best irrelevant and at worst destructive. I'll give you an illustration of this. This didn't happen, but it could have happened. Imagine Louis Pasteur running around the French countryside trying to convince French dairy farmers to boil their milk. The farmer says, Louis, boil the milk? That uses up valuable firewood. It gets cold in the Pyrenees in the winter. Why should I boil the milk? And Pasteur says, well, there are bugs in the milk and they make people sick. Farmer says, bugs in my milk? Louis, let's do an experiment. I have a very finely woven cloth. We'll pour the milk through the cloth and we'll see if the cloth catches any bugs. And Pasteur says, I'm sorry, that's not going to work because these bugs are invisible. Oh, says the farmer, invisible bugs in my milk that make people sick. Louis, go back to Paris with your drinking companions and have fun in your salon, you know, and leave me out of it. I'm not interested in invisible bugs. Well, the farmer can be ever so sarcastic, ever so ironic. It doesn't change the fact there are bacteria in the milk and they do make people sick. You see, reality is ever so politically incorrect. It doesn't care what you think. It doesn't care what you hope. It doesn't care what your values are. The bacteria are there. And if you don't take account of them, you risk your health. Similarly, the underlying dimension is real. It is what it is. And if a person or a group doesn't take account of it, then they risk running afoul of it and losing what they want to try to accomplish. A mitzvah is an action that's appropriate all the way down. Because the creator of the universe gave us a manual how to act in his universe so as to perform actions that are right all the way down. It's sort of like, if you use Word, some of you may be aware, there's a manual for using Word. It has about 1,500 pages. And I thought to myself, why did I buy a computer? So I wouldn't have to read a book. I have to buy the computer and the program and read the book. You know, but if you want to use it right, that's how you use it. The Torah's commandments are the Creator's manual for using the world that He created. Now, our attitude towards mitzvos is split. On the one hand, we are enjoined, maybe commanded, well, we could use that word. We are commanded to investigate the mitzvos and to try to understand them to the best of our ability. Learning Torah, which is a central commandment, has as part of its content understanding the reasons for the mitzvos. There's a whole literature. There's a Sefer HaChinuch, the book of education, which goes through all 613 commandments and gives reasons for all of them. We do not prize blind obedience. On the other hand, we don't make understanding a precondition of obedience. Since we know that the understanding is there and it's available, and we know that this is the way in which the Creator enabled us to live most profitably in His universe, we accept the directions and follow them even before we understand the reasons why. A little bit like the way we expect our 4-year-old children to accept our requirement of hygiene. Before they eat, they must wash, though they don't know why. A lot like the fact that I'll wager there aren't two people in this room that know what goes on under the surface of the computer. All you know is when you press this button, you get that screen. But what's going on underneath? Is it spaghetti or is it leprechauns? Frankly, I don't know, and I don't want to know. I haven't got the time to know that. If it works, it's fine with me. If it doesn't work, I call a technician. But the information is there. And if I would want to know, then I would be able to get the information. In our case, the information is there, and we're commanded to invest in understanding it, but I don't make my present ignorance an obstacle to performing the actions that will be best. Okay, now let's finally go back to the question we started with. What makes us human? What makes us different? Essentially different and unique. One way to put the Jewish answer is this. A human being has the ability to choose the meaning of his life. To choose the meaning of his life. Let's take that apart. What's the meaning of a life? Well, what is meaning? Meaning was relationships, interactions, connections, consequences. The meaning of a life is how it fits. How does it fit into the past, present, and future? As we illustrated, the breakfast cereal has far less meaning than graduating from college because graduating from college is connected. Now you can spread those connections. Where do you stand in the political process of your country and in the historical development of your country? Where do you stand in the development of the world? How connected are you? The more connected you are, the more meaning you have. A human being has the imagination to picture the meanings of different lives. You could imagine yourself going to Moscow and teaching Torah to the Jewish population in Moscow, or going to kibbutz and picking oranges, or doing other things, being a dentist in Iowa. Each of those lives will have a certain meaning. You can picture that, envision that with your intelligence. And, especially at your age, you have ability to make decisions, to decide on a life that has a certain type of meaning. The goal, and this is my last formula, and then I'll stop and take questions. The goal is to have a life of maximum real meaning. Maximum, as many connections as possible. If you have enough information and enough intelligence to envision the creation of the universe and its development up to here and where it's going and how my life can insert to make an influence or an impact on the continuation, then you have a picture of the maximum meaning that a life can have. But that's not enough. There are those who had completely false pictures of the world which were maximal. The communists had a picture of the world from beginning throughout its development, and they could tell you where your life fits and what it will contribute to. It's just that it was a false picture. And there have been many other false pictures. No, we want a life that has maximum real meaning. And that is exactly what the Torah offers. The Torah is a picture of the totality of the creation, including the mystical dimension, which determines the character of the rest. And the mitzvos of the Torah enable a person to insert himself into the world, in his environment, to have the maximally productive effect. And the explanation of the mitzvos gives him the perspective to see how his life contributes to that development. When I was about your age and I was exploring traditional Judaism for the first time, I met someone who said to me, this someone was a chassid, you know, those guys with the funny black hats and the long coats, you probably read about them in history books, they disappeared in the Middle Ages, right? Not quite exactly, although that's what I was taught. He told me his goal in life is that his children should look like his parents. I said, what? Your goal in life is that clothes style shouldn't change? That's your goal? And he said, that's not exactly what I meant. What I meant was that there's a chain. There's a chain of generations going from Abraham to the Messiah. I don't want to be a broken link. I want my children to look like my parents. I want them to be continuation of that chain. This person, every day of his life, and every moment of his life, is living with maximum real meaning. He sees where it starts from, he sees where it's going, and he knows how he's inserting himself into the process to bring the process forward to its ultimate fruition. That's a life of maximum real meaning. Okay, now if there are questions, we have a little while to go. Yeah?
Can I ask a question to you?
Sorry?
Can I ask the same question to you that you asked that gentleman? What do you see as your meaning?
Well, in particular terms, I mean, to me particularly,
yeah.
Well, to find your particular meaning requires guidance of someone who knows the picture well, especially since I wasn't brought up with it, so I was a neophyte, I didn't have any of my own understanding, and someone who can get to know you well and can help you find your appropriate place. Let me make contact with you. If you play a sport seriously and there's a coach, he will assign you a position because he knows better than you what your position should be. He can assess your talents and compare them with the needs of the team and your own future, and he can tell you you're better off in this position rather than that position because of his experience. Similarly, a person who wants to find his position Jewishly goes to a coach, some figure who's had wide experience, has deep and extensive knowledge, and has the insight to see people and to put them, to guide them into their position. My Rebbe, the Boston Rebbe, told me when I was an undergraduate that I have to finish university and get my PhD and become a professor. Didn't tell that to everybody, but that's what he told to me. And I did it. The result of it is I'm here where every day I use almost everything that I've done because I'm able to communicate with people, given that I can share experiences with them that they're familiar with. Other people would have different positions, but that's roughly where I'm standing. Yeah.
I'm not sure if you can go back to the original story.
Well, that's what I meant to do. What makes the human being unique, what his individual essence is, given the way I've described it, is the ability to choose the meaning of your life. No other creature has that ability. You can envision a life and what its meaning is, and you have choices in front of you, and you can choose what to dedicate your life to, where to live, what activities to engage in, and in that way you create the meaning of your own life. That, I think, is one way of putting the Jewish answer to what makes us unique. Yes?
How do you suggest we begin on the path of finding the meaning? Who we should be.
Well, this is a very interesting point. There's a double agenda here, and really, in a certain sense, the two ends of the agenda meet. First, you need to know what are the options. If you don't know what the options are, then it's hard to make a choice, and that requires study of basic Torah sources and the experience of the Torah community to see the various options of how people create this sort of meaning for themselves. But, as I hope you will discover, Torah study is also self-discovery. This isn't just cosmology, or biology, or geology. You are studying a philosophy of the world and a practice of life which realizes your own potential. So as you study and as you experiment with practice and as you imaginatively envision yourself in this system, you reveal to yourself a great deal of your own essence. A great philosopher, Charles Sanders Peirce, one of the first and I would say the greatest of the American philosophers, one of the people that I used to teach, says, you gain knowledge of yourself through experience, just like you gain knowledge of everything else. There's no little private trapdoor which you open up and say, oh, so that's who I am, by peeking inside. Indeed, haven't you all had experiences where you're under certain conditions and you reacted in a way that surprised you? I never knew I would react like that. A crisis. Some people go to pieces and they say, I thought I was stronger than that. I thought I could take that. Other people rise to it and say, I thought I'd be broken by that. And I was able to withstand it. You learn about yourself through experience. It's only that you have vastly more experience of yourself than anyone else has of you, and than you have of anyone else. But you learn about yourself through experience. Through studying Torah and applying it to yourself, both practically and imaginatively, you reveal things in yourself that you never would have expected were there. A fairly tragic case was a fellow who came here after he finished his college education, spent a couple of years here, started to learn Torah, learned Torah well, and then he told me, I regret that I didn't take advantage of college, because I could have learned something there. And he, like a certain percentage, maybe only about 92%, thought that college was for parties. And learning was definitely incidental, and maybe the last 2 weeks of the semester, you cram a bit and try to pass, right? And he didn't realize that if you apply yourself in college, you could really learn valuable material that can help you get on with your life. He only discovered in himself the capacity to appreciate learning when he came to yeshiva. And then he wished he could go back and do the 4 years of college over again. So studying Torah reforms the way you understand yourself and what you understand about the world, and that helps you to find the slot that you can take to have that meaning. You got a question today?
Sure. You speak of intensity of meaning, but also you speak of the veracity of meaning. So how can one be sure of the veracity of one epistemology when there are competing epistemologies out there?
Okay.
For anyone who doesn't know what epistemology means, it's just how you know what you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, I didn't use the word intensity, not once.
You said maximum meaning.
Right.
Which would indicate a sort of spectrum of intensity.
No, maximum indicates a spectrum of extent,
okay.
Not intensity. And I explained that. The more connections you have, that's a matter of how extended it is, not how intense it is.
I was thinking originally of Karl Marx. You know, a fellow whose meaning has, you know, just like uncountable extent, immeasurable.
Right. And I use that as an example. I use Marx. I'm finished.
Okay.
Okay. I used Marx as my example of someone who has maximal meaning, that is to say, maximum extensive meaning, but it isn't correct. Now, secondly, although you did define epistemology correctly, I don't think that's quite the question that should be asked. We're not now dealing with different epistemologies, that is, different philosophical positions in epistemology. What I think you mean is different theories of reality, all of which might be tested by the same epistemology, which would mean that, just as I accused the Marxist picture of being untrue, how do I know that our picture is true? That's a key question, and I will give you some information on that, though your stay is so short that I can't do the whole job. It is done on my website in various versions, and I refer you to that. But we will have at least 2 sessions on Sinai. The evidence that we have that Sinai is a real event, and of course, if Sinai is a real event, then that's a key element in the picture. But of course, it is important. And that's why I used the analogy of the scientist. I did that to provoke exactly that question. The question is, if the scientist can give me evidence that what he says is a true picture of reality, shouldn't you also give me evidence that your picture is true? And the answer is yes, we should give evidence, and we have evidence. And indeed, we will see the evidence, some of the evidence, in the course of the lectures. Okay, yes?
Yeah, you spoke of continuous creation kind of as a given. How do we know that the world is continuously created?
Okay, this is very important. And maybe with this, I will stop for today because we do have to daven mincha, those who daven. And then we have to go on to the next year, 4:30. A great deal of what we know about God and what we know about how he runs the world, we know because he told us. Otherwise, these items are not accessible to us by our own direct inspection. No scientific inspection would reveal this. Well, maybe you could have something from about 1930 to 1965. The official scientific cosmology of the world was that matter is coming into existence out of nothing throughout the universe. Which is pretty surprising, actually. Matter coming into existence out of nothing? That's what's called the steady state theory. And they accepted that as scientists? They bought that? Yeah, they bought it. They bought it because the alternative that was that there should be a beginning to the universe, and they didn't want that for sure. I'm quoting Stephen Hawking now. So, maybe indirectly you could have evidence that something's going on, you know, that conservation is violated grandly throughout the entire universe. More stuff is coming in from nowhere all the time. One could then wonder how that's happening, why it's happening, who's doing that. Right? But that crashed in 1965. Now they have to live with the beginning, which was worse. So the large part of it is because God told us, and because he told us many things which we could verify in our own experience. And when we verified them, he gains credibility, like any other source of information. And since he gains credibility through that information, when he tells us other things we can't verify, we trust him. Sort of like trusting the Encyclopedia Britannica, and sort of like not trusting the BBC. Because your experience tells you that the BBC gets it wrong quite often. Okay, let's have a minute.